Thousands of pages of reports filled with military slang dashed off in an instant and focusing on the aspects of the war that are arguably the least important. This is how Noah Strachman sums up most of the WikiLeaks documents released earlier this week. And he should know, he was embedded in Afghanistan and saw firsthand one of the battles mentioned in the leaked military reports. We'll talk with him in a moment about why the documents do not give us the full picture of the war in Afghanistan and to explain how best to read them. We also want to hear from our listeners in uniform. Are you reading the documents? What do they tell you? Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's our phone number. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And to join the conversation, go to the website npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Noah Strachman is the editor of Wired's national security blog, Danger Room, and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. We have posted a link to his post, My War, WikiLeaked, at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. He joins us now from our bureau in New York. Noah, nice to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You base your opinion on experience, and you titled your piece, What I Saw at MobaCon. What exactly did you see there, one of the battles mentioned in the leaked documents?
Right. So in August of last year, I was in Helmand Province with a group of Marines from Echo Company, 28 Marines. And they were involved in some very heavy fighting with local militants there. And so I spent a bunch of time there as they went out and patrol and almost daily got into firefights. And many of those firefights were, turns out, were in the WikiLeaks documents. And so I decided to go take a look at those WikiLeaks documents and see what they said about those battles. And as I looked, it became more and more curious to me, the more and more incomplete the reports in WikiLeaks seemed. So, for example, the WikiLeaks document mentions a bomb being dropped and that enemy fire was then suppressed. Well, I happen to know because I was there that the enemy fire was suppressed for all of 17 minutes and then the fighting started all over again.
Would you say that these facts are simply missed? Are they errors or are they intentional omissions, do you think? And is there a way to even know that?
I don't think there's any lying involved. I don't think there's any intentional omissions. I think these are really short, really fast, really compressed reports given from a junior officer to a more senior officer. You can read them almost like interoffice memos, and we all know that interoffice memos don't necessarily tell us what happens at the office.
You know, looking at some of these excerpts, they're difficult for a non-military person perhaps to understand and to break down some of the jargon and language. Is there a way you can help those who want to read them to understand what it is they are reading?
Well, yeah, there is some jargon. There is some – I mean, you know, the military is filled with jargon, and the number of acronyms and jargon in these reports is greater than most. But the thing to keep in mind about these reports is that they're really focusing on the sort of bombs and bullets part of the war. They're focused on what gets blown up and who gets killed and who gets shot and how many rounds of ammunition are being spent. And the thing is that in a fight like Afghanistan, those are often the metrics that matter the least, okay?
Well, let's explore that for a moment because I'm not sure how the loss of life would be something that you could consider to be not as important as something else. What else would be more important than that?
Well, look, of course, every life is precious. I'm not saying that the lives aren't important. But what I'm saying is that counterinsurgency isn't just about who shoots who. Counterinsurgency is a contest, right? It's a contest between the militants and the government, and you know we're sort of there on the government side. It's a contest that includes everything from armed coercion to political persuasion. And these documents only really cover the coercion, the armed coercion part. They don't cover, did a farmer bring his crops to market? Are the local cops corrupt? How's the local government doing? Who do the people trust? Those are the kind of key questions that guys like David Petraeus really count on to find out how the insurgency or counterinsurgency is going. And they're not the kind of things that are conveyed in these reports.
Now, there are said to be 90,000 pages of this of these documents. How much of it have you read?
A very small fraction of it. But I did look at all the documents that pertain to the unit that I was with, Echo Company, of the 2-8 Marines.
Now, overall, would you say that while there are discrepancies or omissions in terms of what you saw based on the experience that you had with Echo Company, does it give you a sense that maybe there are other and larger omissions elsewhere throughout that maybe undermine the veracity of this?
I wouldn't term it as omissions. I'd term it more as, you know, this is one piece of evidence in a larger group of evidence if you want to learn about the war. There's nothing in here that's I don't think that it's lies or, you know, willful omissions. It's just that it's a very small slice of a much larger picture.
All right, let's take a call. We have Harry joining us from St. Louis, Missouri. Harry, you're on Talk of the Nation. Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. It just struck me in reading some of this stuff that's very similar to what we used to see coming out of Vietnam, which was you could be in the same fight and get five different people, and they'd be five different descriptions of what happened, depending on their perspective. And the only thing that continues to appall me, as it did then, was that we're in a situation where it appears that civilian casualties are inevitable, and every time there is that kind of outcome of a battle, you've essentially strategically lost anything you might have gained by fighting that battle. And, you know, we saw that again and again and again in Vietnam, and nobody really recognized it.
Harry, thank you for that. He brings up an interesting point, I think, Noah. That is, you can put five people in the same situation, and they will come out with five different descriptions of what happened. Do you think that is maybe what happened with Echo Company?
Well, I think that's part of it. You know, that's like the famous movie Rashomon is kind of based around that. And I do think that that is definitely an issue. I think, look, you know, people reading these documents might be inclined to think that they are reading the capital T truth, the raw, unvarnished truth. But they're not. It's one person's perspective that's giving information to their boss. So it's not, you know, it's still one person's point of view. And people reading this have to use the same kind of critical reading skills that they would if they're reading a newspaper article or watching a report on Fox News. I'm sorry, but to the caller's second point about civilian casualties, I'd be remiss if I didn't note that the captain in Echo Company passed up several opportunities to authorize an airstrike during this very long battle in which his troops were at risk. There are several opportunities where his troops were surrounded on three sides, and dropping a bomb could probably end the fight right then and there. But because of the very tight restrictions that General McChrystal put on airstrikes, and because of the captain's fear that there might be loss of either civilian life or even civilian property, he decided not to drop a bomb several times. And so I think that's important to note, too, that the military, you know, isn't just running around Afghanistan trying to blow up whatever and whoever they want.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Tony Cox, and we're talking with Noah Schachtman, editor of Wired's national security blog, Danger Room, talking about the WikiLeaks and whether or not they can be believed and to what extent they can be believed. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Let's go to Boston and take a call from Vijay. Vijay, welcome. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I was a marine linguist, Arabic linguist in Iraq. Got out last year. I'm a student here in Boston now, and I've been taking a look at some of these reports too. And I actually have to agree with the guest, Mr. Schachtman. I mean, these reports really don't say all that much. You know, in a more in-depth level, we worked on the top secret level when I was in Iraq, and there are teams of linguists and analysts that are going through, you know, doing their jobs and basically having a much more in-depth analytical perspective than the reports that we see here, which are at the secret level. So, you know, I mean, these paint very, 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 very immediate pictures, but not very intimate pictures of the situation on the ground.
Well, Vijay, let me ask you, because of your experience, when you read them, did you think that there was, A, information missing, or B, that there was misinformation that was perhaps misleading, or C, that the information contained here wasn't very significant to begin with?
Well, I think that the information contained therein wasn't actually very significant. These reports aren't meant to give, you know, higher-level commanders this overall big picture of what's going on. The reports are meant to be, you know, basically a catalog of what's happened day-to-day. You can kind of look at them as a military spreadsheet at the secret level in some ways. Just, you know, these are metrics like your guest said. So, I mean, they're useful in tracking when you compile all this information and look at it from, you know, a much kind of farther perspective. When you look at it from a long perspective and say, okay, on this day, such and such happened. Over a course of this many months, these reports happened. That gives you an idea of the numbers of what's going on and, you know, some of the resources that we're allocating. And whether you're looking at it as coalition troops, you know, ISAF or civilian casualties, you know, numbers do matter. Of course, every single life counts, too. Everybody's going to say that, but numbers do matter, too. And these give lower-level commanders generally an idea of what's going on, but these aren't, until you take this information and really do a thorough analysis of it and bring in a lot more factors that are more than just these small instant pictures of what's going on, that's where your analysis actually comes in. That's where people make decisions that have more strategic impact.
Vijay, thank you very much for the call. That was good information, which raises a question in my mind for you, Noah, and it's this. The person or persons responsible for leaking this information obviously thought that it had some import. Did they just not know what they were talking about?
I'm not sure they did think it had a ton of import. I mean, the leading suspect in these leaks seemed to have just trolled around the top secret network, which is called JWIX, and just kind of took everything he could. So I'm not necessarily sure that there was a lot of attention paid to, oh, this is particularly damaging, let me take it, or this is particularly not damaging, let me take it. I think from what we know so far, with the leading suspect seems to have just taken things willy-nilly.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You talked earlier, Noah, about what you described as the capital T truth. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way ever for us to get the capital T truth about what is occurring on the ground in Afghanistan?
Okay, this gets into some crazy postmodern debate about relative truth versus absolute truth. Okay, there's probably no way to get to absolute truth, but there's ways of approaching absolute truth. And I'm not sure that these very short messages about what happened at a particular fight in Afghanistan get any closer to the absolute capital T truth than, like, you know, a haiku does about a mountain stream.
Well, you know, you talk about in your Wall Street Journal op-ed where you tell us and you give the impression to the reader that, you know, beware, reader, you are not going to get the truth necessarily. You are not going to get the entire truth in terms of what you might read from these leaked documents. So it leaves lay people, I think, myself included, not sure where to go or how to process what it is we are seeing. Are you able to provide perhaps for people who are in the process of reading these documents or who are intending to read them, give us a primer on how we should go about reading them?
You know, I'd read them as very short messages from the field to to higher officers. I'd read them as really very small data points that have got to be read alongside, you know, newspaper articles, longer narratives. I think to look at them in isolation really isn't going to tell you a lot. Most of these are just, you know, received fire, returned fire, you know, this many wounded, this much ammunition expended. It's pretty thin gruel.
What does it tell you? What do these documents tell you about the communication within the military? It seems like a murky, muddled mess.
Right. I do think these documents say something interesting about how the military talks to itself. You know, the military set up a reporting structure, a system of conveying information, you know, that worked really well for, let's say, Korea or for the first Gulf War, where the emphasis was really on, you know, destroying the enemy and doing so in the most efficient way possible. But counterinsurgency is a messier game, and different kinds of metrics are involved, and different kind of information has to be conveyed from one member of the military to another.
I think we can squeeze one more call in. This is Christopher from Greenville, North Carolina. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. My comment was just, I was surprised at the outcry of horror once the documents released and people started to look through them. Was anyone actually surprised by the information that they found in the documents, the fact that, you know, there were civilians that were unreported as casualties, and besides the fact that the information is, you know, not verified, and a lot of it, like you said, is just basically inter-office memos. Where was this outcry when we have, you know, actual verified atrocities like the detention and torture of Iraqis and Afghanis in Cuba, and the false pretenses we went to war under in the first place?
Well, Christopher, let me interrupt you and apologize for doing so. It's not because your question wasn't good. It's because we're running out of time, and I want to give Noah an opportunity to quickly respond to that. Thank you.
I mean, it's a little hard for me to respond to that, you know, to answer for anybody's outrage or lack of outrage. You know, I think there's a lot of really interesting material in the documents. There's a lot of really great details about how the war's been conducted and how small units went about their business. I just think that it can't be relied on.
Is it worth reading?
Yeah, I do think it's worth reading, and it's going to be frustrating for a lot of people. It's going to be slow going, and they're going to have to look up a lot of acronyms. But I do think that they're, you know, if you've got the time to kind of troll through these things, I think you'll learn some pretty interesting stories.
Thank you very much for coming on. Noah Schachtman is the editor of Wired's national security blog, Danger Room, and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Tomorrow, there's genetic code from nasty viruses lurking in the human genome. Join Joe Palca on Talk of the Nation Science Friday for a look at how it got there. I'm Tony Cox. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.